Chapter 2. They had only been climbing for 20 minutes, but already Lemuel was beginning to regret his hasty idea to spy upon the Thousand Suns. He discovered the steps, hidden in the rocks on one of his frequent solitary walks in the lower reaches of the Titanic Mountain. Set in a cunningly concealed cleft 100 meters from the dead stones, the steps wound through the rock of the mountain, climbing a steep but far more direct path than the Astartes would be following. It might be more direct, but it certainly wasn't easier. His banyan was stained with sweat, and he imagined he didn't smell too pleasant. The sound of his heart was like the pounding kettle drums of a triumphal band welcoming the Emperor himself. "How much further is it?" asked Camille. She was relishing this chance to venture deeper into the mountain, though Callista appeared rather less enthusiastic. The Astartes awed and scared her, but the idea of spying on them had sent a delicious thrill through her when he had suggested it. He couldn't read her aura, but her expression said she was regretting her decision to come along. Lemuel paused, looking up at the metal yellow of the sky to catch his breath and slow his racing heartbeat.
"Another 10 minutes, maybe," he said.
"You sure you'll last that long?" asked Camille, only half-joking.
"I'll be fine," he assured her,
taking a swig of water from his canteen.
"I've climbed this way before. It's not much higher, I think."
"Just don't collapse on me," said Camille. "I don't want to have to carry you back down."
"You can always row me back down,"
Lemuel replied, attempting some levity. "Seriously," said Camille, "are you sure you're up to this climb?"
"I'm fine," he insisted, with more conviction than he felt. "Trust me, it's worth the effort."
Back at the Deadstones, it had seemed like a grand adventure for the three of them to undertake, but the numbness of the senses, he felt, was like having his ears stoppered and his eyes sewn shut. From below, the mountain had been a black wall of nothingness, but climbing deeper into the rocks, Lemuel felt as if that nothingness was swallowing him whole. He passed the canteen around, grateful that Callista and Camille indulged his desire to stop for a rest. It was early evening, but the day's heat hadn't let up. Still, at least there was some shade here. They could afford a brief stop, for the only other route he knew would take at least an hour to traverse, even for Astartes. Lemuel took the bandana from around his neck and mopped his face. The cloth was soaked by the time he was done, and he wrung it out with a grimace. Camille looked up the steps, craning her neck to try to see the top. "So where does this lead exactly?" she asked.
"There's a plateau a bit higher up," he said. "It's like a viewing platform of some sort."
"A viewing platform?" asked Callista. "For what?"
"It looks out over a wide valley I call the Temple of the Ciborte."
"Ciborte?" asked Camille. "What's that?"
"A very old legend of my homeland," replied Lemuel. "The Ciborte were a race of giants from the Ethiopian kingdom of Miro."
"Why do you call it that? A temple, I mean?" asked Callista, horrified at the word.
"You'll understand when we get there."
"You have a way of choosing words that could get you into trouble," said Camille.
"Not at all, my dear," said Lemuel. "The Thousand Suns are nothing if not rebels. I think they would appreciate the irony."
"Rebels? What are you talking about?" asked Callista angrily.
Nothing, said Lemuel,
realizing he had said too much. Stripped of his ability to read auras, he was being careless.
Just a bad joke.
He smiled to reassure Callista he had been joking, and she smiled back.
Come on, he said. We should get going. I want to show you something spectacular.
It took them another 30 minutes to reach the plateau, by which time Lemuel swore never to climb the mountain again, no matter how spectacular the views or what the enticement. The sound of his drumming heartbeat seemed louder than ever, and Lemuel vowed to shed some weight before it killed him. The sky was a darker shade of yellow-brown. The light would never really fade, so he wasn't worried about negotiating the descent. "This is amazing," said Callista, looking back the way they had climbed. "You were so right, Lemuel." "Yep," agreed Camille, taking out her picture. "Not bad at all." Lemuel shook his head.
"No, not the salt flats. Over there," he said, waving towards a row of spiked rocks that looked like slender stalagmites at the edge of the plateau.
If the artificiality of the mountain had ever been in doubt, the sight of the stalagmites, which were clearly the remains of fluted balustrades, would have dispelled it.
"Over there," he said, between gulps of air. "Look, over there."
Camille and Callista walked over to the stalagmites, and he saw the amazement in their body language. He smiled, pleased that he hadn't let them down with his talk of a spectacular view. He stood up and stretched his back. His breath was returning to normal, but the drumming in his ears hadn't let up one bit. "You weren't wrong to call it a temple," said Camille, looking down into the valley.
"Yes, it's quite a view, isn't it?" said Lemuel, regaining some of his composure.
"It is, but that's not what I mean."
"It's not?"
he asked, finally realizing that the drumming he was hearing wasn't in his head. It was coming from the valley, a haunting, relentless beat that was hypnotic and threatening at the same time. The percussive booms of scores of drums interleaved with brutal disharmony, plucking at Lemuel's nerves and sending tremors of unease down his spine. Intrigued, he walked stiffly on tired legs to join the two women at the edge of the plateau. He put a hand on Camille's shoulder and looked down into the valley. His eyes widened and his jaw hung open in surprise.
"Throne of Terror," he said.
Ahriman heard the drums, recognizing the dissonant notes echoing from the mountain as those once declared forbidden in an ancient age. Nothing good could come of such a sound, and Ahriman felt certain that something unnatural was being orchestrated within the valley. The Sekhmet matched his pace, their heavy suits driven on by uncompromising will and strength. "This bodes ill," said Phocis to Kaa, as the drums grew louder. "Damn, but I do not like this place. I am blind here." "We all are," replied Hathor Mart, looking towards the upper reaches of the valley. Ahriman shared Phocis Takar's hatred of the blindness. As one of the Legion's adept exemptus, he had attained supreme summits of mastery, etheric flight, connection with the tutelary, and the rites of evocation and invocation. The Sekhmet were powerful warrior mages, and could call forth powers mortal men could never dream of wielding. On his own, each warrior was capable of subduing worlds, but in this place, with their powers denied them, they were simply Astartes. Simply Astartes, thought Ahriman with a smile. How arrogant that sounds. Even as he scanned the valley ahead, Ahriman began forming the basis of a treatise for his grimoire, a discourse on the perils of dependence and overweening pride. "There is a lesson here," he said. "It will do us good to face this without our powers. We have become lax in making war as it was once made." "Always the teacher, eh?" said Phocis to Kaa. "Always," agreed Ahriman, "and always the student. Every experience is an opportunity to learn." "So what lesson can I possibly learn here?" demanded Hathor Mart. Of them all, Mart had the greatest dread of powerlessness, and the walk into the mountain had tested his courage in ways beyond what they had faced before. "We depend on our abilities to define us," said Ahriman, feeling the bass vibration of the drums through the soles of his armoured boots. "We must learn to fight as Astartes again." "Why?" demanded Hathor Mart. "We have been gifted with power. The power of the primordial creator is in all of us, so why should we not use it?" Ahriman shook his head. Like him, Hathor Mart had faced the Dominus Liminus, but his mastery of the enumerations was that of adept major. He had achieved self-reliance, but he had yet to achieve the oneness of self and ego extinction that would allow him to reach the higher enumerations. Few Pavoni could, and Ahriman suspected Hathor Mart was no exception. "You might as well send us in unarmed and say we should fight with our bare hands," continued Hathor Mart. "Some day you may have to do just that," said Ahriman. The ground, which had been steadily rising for the last hour, began to climb ever more steeply, and the sound of drums grew louder, as though amplified by the soaring walls of the valley. As it always was, Ahriman's gaze was drawn up the incredible height of the mountain. The summit was hidden from view by its sheer mass, an endless slope rearing into a cloudless, yellow sky that was darkening to burnt orange. It seemed inconceivable that this towering peak had been raised by natural means. Its proportions were too perfect, its form too pleasing to the eye, and its curves and lines flowed with a grace that was wholly unnatural. Ahriman had seen such perfect artifice before, on Prospero. The Vitruvian pyramids and cult temples of Tizcar were constructed using golden means and the numeral series of the Liber Abaci. Their work had been distilled and refined by Magnus the Red to fashion the City of Light with such beauty that all who beheld it were rendered speechless with delight. Everywhere Ahriman looked, he saw evidence of geometric perfection, as though the mountain's creator had studied the divine proportions of the ancients and crafted the landmass to their design. Spiral patterns on the ground described perfect curves, pillars of rock were equally spaced, and each angle of cliff and cleft was artfully arranged with mathematical exactitude. Ahriman wondered what cause could be so great as to require such magnificent feats of geomorphic sculpting. The mouth of the valley funneled the sound of drums towards them, the beats rising and falling in what, at first, seemed a random pattern, but which Ahriman's enhanced cognitive processes quickly discerned was not random at all. "Prime armaments," he ordered, and 50 weapons snapped up in unison. A mix of storm-bolters, flamers, and newly issued rotary cannons capable of unleashing thousands of shells per minute. Their official designation was assault cannon, but such a graceless name had none of the power of its former incarnation, and numerological study had led the Thousand Suns to keep its previous title, the Reaper Cannon. The Mechanicum had not the wit or understanding to recognise the power of names or the mastery and fear a well-chosen one could instil. With 6 letters, 3 vowels and 3 consonants, the Reaper's number was 9. Given the organisation of the Thousand Sons into a pesage of 9 fellowships, it was a natural fit and the name had remained. Ahriman recited the mantras that lifted his mind into the lower enumerations and calmed his supra-enhanced physiology, allowing him to better process information and react without fear in a hostile environment. Normally this process would enhance his awareness of his surroundings, the essential nature of the world around him laid bare to his senses, but on this mountain the landscape was dead and lifeless to him. Ahriman saw the diffuse glow of torches and fires ahead. The vibration of the ground was like the heartbeat of the mountain. Was he an ant crawling on the body of some large organism, insignificant and easily swatted aside? "Zagaya," said Ahriman, and the Sekhmet formed a staggered arrowhead with him at its point. Other legions knew this formation as the spear tip, and though Ahriman appreciated the robust, forceful nature of the term, he preferred the ancient name taught to him by the Emperor on Terra at the island fortress of Demon's Land. Phocis Takar moved alongside him, and Ahriman recognized the urge for violence that filled his fellow captain. In his detached state, Ahriman wondered why he always called Phocis Takar his fellow and never his friend. "What are our orders?" asked Hathor Mart, tense and on edge. "No violence unless I order it," said Ahriman, opening the vox to the Sekhmet. "This is a march of investigation, not of war."
"But be ready for it to become a war," added Phocis Takar with relish.
"Sekhmet, align your humours," ordered Ahriman, using his mastery of the enumerations to alter his body's internal alchemy. "Temper the choleric with the phlegmatic and bring the sanguine to the fore." Ahriman heard Hathor Mart muttering under his breath. Normally a Pavoni could balance his humours with a thought, but without access to the ether, Hathor Mart had to do it like the rest of them, with discipline, concentration, and self-will. The valley widened, and Ahriman saw a host of figures standing at the crest of the slope, like the legendary warriors of Leonidas who fought and died at Thermopylae. Ahriman felt nothing for them, no hatred and no fear. In the lower enumerations, he was beyond such considerations. With their sunset-coloured robes, baked leather breastplates and long phalarica, the Agoru warriors were the very image of the barbarian tribes of ancient Terra. The warriors were not facing down the valley to repel invaders, but were instead focused on something deeper in the valley and beyond his sight. Ahriman's fingers flexed on the hide grip of his bolter. The warriors above turned at the sound of the Sekhmet's advance, and Ahriman saw they were all wearing masks of polished glass. Expressionless and without life, they resembled the gold-leaf corpse masks placed upon the faces of ancient Mycenaean kings to conceal the decay of their features. At the most recent conclave of the Rehati, Magnus had invited Yatiri, the leader of the Ogoru tribes gathered at the mountain, to speak with them. The proud chieftain stood in the centre of Magnus's austere pavilion, clad in saffron robes and wearing the ceremonial mirror mask of his people. Yattery carried a black-bladed phalarica and a hecastaff, not unlike those carried by the captains of the Thousand Sons. Though centuries of isolation had separated his people from the Imperium, the regal Yattery spoke with clarity and fluency as he requested they refrain from entering the valley, explaining that it was a holy place to his people. Holy, and that was the word he had used. Such a provocative word would have raised the hackles of many Astartes legions, but the Thousand Sons understood the original meaning of the term, uninjured, sound, healthy, and rose above its connotations of divinity to recognize it for what it truly meant, a place free of imperfection. Yattery's request had roused some suspicion among the legion, but Magnus had given his oath that the Thousand Sons would respect his wishes. That request had been honoured until this moment. The Agoru parted as the Sekhmet approached the crest of the valley, the sharpened blades of their phalarica glittering in firelight. Ahriman had no fear of such weapons, but he had no wish to start a fight he didn't need to. Ahriman marched towards the Agoru, keeping his pace steady, and his gaze was lifted upwards in awed amazement as the titanic guardians of the valley were revealed to his sight. On Prospero, the cult temple of the Pirae was a vast pyramid of silvered glass with an eternally burning finial at its peak. Where the other cult temples of Tizcar raised golden idols of their cult symbols before their gates, the Pirae boasted a battle engine of the Titan legions. Supplicants to the pyromancers approached along a brazier-lit processional of red marble towards a mighty warlord Titan. Bearing the proud name Canis Vertex, the engine had once walked beneath the banners of Legio Astorum, its carapace emblazoned with a faded black disc, haloed by a flaming blue corona. Its princeps was killed and its moderati crushed when the engine fell during the bloody campaigns of extermination waged in the middle years of the Great Crusade against the barbaric greenskin of the Kamenka Troika. The Emperor had issued the writs of war, commanding the Thousand Sons, Legio Astorum, and a life host of Panpak Eugenians to drive that savage race of Xenos from the three satellite planets of Kamenka Ulizana, a world claimed by the Mechanicum of Mars. Ahriman remembered well the savagery of that war, the slaughter and relentless grinding attrition that left tens of thousands dead in its wake. Imperial forces had been victorious after 2 years of fighting and earned a score of honours for the war banners. Victory had been won, but the cost had been high. 873 warriors of the Thousand Sons had died, forcing Magnus to reduce his legion from 10 fellowships to the Pesage, the 9 fellowships of antiquity. Of greater sorrow to Ahriman was the death of Apophis, captain of the 5th fellowship and his oldest friend. Only now that Apophis was dead was Ahriman able to use that word. Canis Vertex had been brought down on the killing fields of Coriovallum in the last days of the war by a gargantuan war machine of the Greenskin, crudely built in the image of their warlike gods. Defeat seemed inevitable until Magnus stood before the enemy Colossus, wielding the power of the ether like an ancient god of war. Two giants, one mechanical, one a flesh-and-blood progeny of the Emperor, they had faced each other across the burning ruins, and it seemed the battle's conclusion could not have been more foregone. But Magnus raised his arms, his feathered cloak billowed by unseen storms, and the full fury of the ether unmade the enemy war engine in a hurricane of immaterial fire that tore the flesh of reality asunder and shook the world to its very foundations. All those who saw the giant Primarch that day would take the sight of his battle with that bloated, hateful war machine to their graves, his power and majesty indelibly etched on their memories like a scar. 10,000 warriors bowed their heads to their saviour as he returned to them across a field of the dead. The Legio Astorum contingent had been destroyed, and Colophis of the 6th Fellowship had honoured their sacrifice by transporting Canis Vertex back to Prospero and setting it as a silent guardian to the Temple of the Pirae. The raising of such a colossal sentinel was typical Piray showmanship, but there was no doubting the impact made by the sight of the dead engine sheened in the orange firelight of the temple. Adaman was no stranger to the impossible scale of the Mechanicum war engines, but he had never seen anything to compare with the Guardians of the Valley. Taller than Canis Vertex, the identical colossi that stood at the end of the valley were, like the mountain they inhabited, enormous beyond imagining. Soaring, graceful and threatening, they were mighty bipedal constructions that resembled an impossibly slender humanoid form. Crafted from something that resembled porcelain or ceramic, the colour of bone, they were manufactured as though moulded from one enormous block. Their heads were like sinuous helmets, studded with glittering gems, and graceful spines flared from their shoulders like angelic wings. These guardians were prepared for war. One arm ended in a mighty fist, the other in an elongated lance-like weapon, its slim barrel gracefully fluted and hung with faded banners. "Sweet mother of the abyss," said Phocis Dakar at the sight of them. Adaman felt the calm he had established within him crumble when confronted by such powerful icons of war. Like gods of battle, the towering creations rendered everything in the valley inconsequential. He saw the same grace and aesthetic in these guardians as he had seen in the valley's formation. Whoever had willed this mountain into existence had also crafted these guardians to watch over it. "What are they?" asked Hathor Mart. "I don't know," said Adaman. "Xenos Titans?" "They have the look of Eldar about them," said Phocis Dakar. Adaman agreed. 2 decades ago, the Thousand Suns had detected a fleet of Eldar vessels on the edge of the Perdis Anomaly. The encounter had been cordial, both forces passing on their way without violence, but Adaman had never forgotten the elegance of the Eldar ships and the ease with which they navigated the stars. "There must be war engines," said Hathor Mart. "Calophis would kill to see this." That was certainly true. Calophis was Piray, and a warmongering student of conflict in all its most brutal forms. If an enemy was to be wiped from the battlefield with overwhelming firepower, it was to Calophis the Thousand Suns turned. "I'm sure he would," said Adaman, dragging his eyes from the titanic war machines. The valley was filled with Aguru tribesmen, all bearing burning brands or battering their palms bloody on tribal drums. Phocis Dakar held his bolt pistol at his side, but Adaman could see his urge to use it was strong. Hathor Mart held his Hecker staff at the ready. Warriors who had faced the Dominus Liminus and achieved the rank of Adept could release devastating bursts of etheric energy through their staffs, but here it was no more than a symbol of rank.
"Hold to the enumerations," he whispered. "There is to be no killing unless I give the word."
Perhaps 1,000 men and women in hooded robes and reflective masks filled the valley. Surrounding a great altar of basalt that stood before a yawning cave mouth set in the cliff between the towering guardians. Adaman immediately saw that this cave was no deliberately crafted entrance to the mountain. An earthquake had ripped it open, and the blackness of it seemed darker than the depths of space. "What's going on here?" demanded Phocis Dakar.
"I do not know," said Adaman,
advancing cautiously through the Aguru, seeing the crimson plates of the Sekhmet's armour reflected in their masks. The chanting ceased, and the drumming diminished, until the valley was utterly silent.
"Why are they watching?" hissed Hathor Mart. "Why don't they move?"
"They're waiting to see what we do," replied Adaman. It was impossible to read the Aguru behind their masks, but he didn't think there was any hostile intent. The mirror-masked tribesmen simply watched as Adaman led the Sekhmet through the crowds towards the basalt altar. Its smooth, black surface gleamed in the last of the day's light, like the still waters of a motionless black pool. Tokens lay strewn across the altar's surface, bracelets, earrings, dolls of woven reeds and bead necklaces, the personal effects of scores of people. Adaman saw footprints in the dust leading from the altar to the black tear in the mountainside. Whoever had made them had gone back and forth many times. He knelt beside the tracks as Phocis Dakar and Hathor Mart approached the altar.
"What are these?" wondered Phocis Dakar.
"Offerings," ventured Hathor Mart, lifting a neck torque of copper and onyx and examining the workmanship with disdain. "'To what?' asked Phocis Takkar. "'I didn't read of any practices of the Agoru like this.'
"'Nor I. But how else do you explain it?'
"'Yatiri told us the mountain is a place of the dead,' said Ahriman, "'tracing the outline of a print clearly made by someone of far greater stature "'than any mortal or Astartes.
"'Perhaps this is a rite of memorial,' said Phocis Takkar.
"'You could be right,' conceded Hathor Mart. "'But then, where are the dead?'
"'They're in the mountain,' said Ahriman, "'backing away from the cave as the drums began once again. "'He rejoined his warriors, planting his staff in the dusty ground.' As one, the Ogoru turned their mirrored masks towards the end of the valley, chanting in unison and moving forwards with short, shuffling steps, the butts of their phalarica thumping on the ground in time with every beat of the drums.
"Mandala!" ordered Ahriman, and the Sekhmet formed a circle around the altar. Auto-loaders clattered and power fists crackled as energy fields engaged. "'Permission to open fire,' requested Hathor Mart, aiming his bolt pistol at the mask of the nearest Ogoru tribesman.
"'No,' said Ahriman, turning to face the darkness of the cave mouth as wind-blown ash gusted from the depths of the mountain.
"'This isn't for us.'
Bleak despair tainted the wind.
The dust and memory of a billion corpses decayed to powder and forgotten in the lightless depths of the world.
A shape emerged from the cave, wreathed in swirling ash, hulking crimson and gold and monstrous.